Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. A team of UN atomic energy experts set out on Monday for Zaporizhzhia's nuclear power station in Ukraine after weeks of rising tensions between Ukrainian and Russian forces who have accused each other of shelling the plant. In a tweet, Rafael Grossi, head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, said that he would lead the agency's support and assistance mission to Zaporizhzhia, which is under Russian control. The day has come to protect the safety and security of the plant, which is Europe's largest, Mr. Grossi wrote on Twitter, alongside a photograph of himself and 13 other IAEA staff preparing for their mission. Once the IAEA team arrives in Zaporizhzhia later this week, Mr. Grossi said that priorities included carrying out damage assessments and evaluating whether safety and security systems at Zaporizhzhia remained functional. Other urgent tasks also include checking on the welfare of the Ukrainian staff still running the plant, which houses six of the country's 15 nuclear reactors. In a related development, the UN-led initiative to secure shipments of grain and other foodstuffs from Ukraine's Black Sea ports said that around 1.25 million metric tons have now been successfully shipped. The update on Sunday from the Joint Coordination Centre, which involves Ukraine, Russia, Turkey and the UN, reported that 62 inbound and 52 outbound voyages had been approved since the agreement was signed on the 27th of July in Istanbul. Three commercial vessels were authorised to move on Monday from Ukrainian ports, carrying more than 70,000 tons of foodstuffs. One of the ships, the Carteria, was due to depart for Turkey with 37,500 metric tons of wheat purchased by the UN World Food Programme, WFP. It will be milled to flour in Turkey, and it will then be loaded onto a new ship that will head to Yemen, the Joint Coordination Centre said. To Ethiopia, where top rights experts appointed by the UN Human Rights Council have condemned a deadly attack on a children's playground in Tigray. The development comes after renewed fighting last week between the government of Ethiopia and the Tigray People's Liberation Front, breaking a four-month humanitarian truce. Media reports indicated that at least seven people, including three children, were killed in the airstrike in Mekele, the capital of Tigray region in northern Ethiopia, last Friday. Such fighting only worsens the hardships on civilians and risks a violent escalation, warned the International Commission of Human Rights Experts for Ethiopia. The panel of experts was established by the Human Rights Council in December 2021 at the request of member states who'd expressed alarm at spreading violence in Tigray and beyond, and the dire humanitarian crisis that has resulted from a lack of aid access. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Coming to you live from Northeast Jefferson.
Blog Talk Radio.
I'm going to
Radio Free Kansas.
Kansas.
Let's talk about
Radio Free Kansas out of North Jefferson County, Kansas.
Common side effects include heart failure, persistent fever, bruising, bleeding, lymphoma, nervous system, and blood disorders.
The message is now part of and registered in your subconscious mind. Every time you say, see, hear, or think,
Radio Free Kansas,
that's your key phrase. It will trigger the entire message without your being aware of it.
Oh man, that is just wrong.
If you wish to survive, you need to cultivate a strong mental attitude.
It's a fool who looks for logic in the chambers of the human heart.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, at least 30 people are dead and hundreds more injured after fighting intensified in the capital, Baghdad, between supporters and opponents of the powerful Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. The violence came after al-Sadr's announcement Monday he's quitting politics. Gunshots and rocket fire erupted overnight as Iraqi security forces, Iran-backed militias, and supporters of al-Sadr clashed in Baghdad's heavily fortified Green Zone, an area that houses Iraq's parliament and foreign embassies.
Before, we were committed to the orders of Muqtada al-Sadr. Now he took his hand away from us. He withdrew from politics. He is letting the people take the lead in their own revolution. We are not going back. We will die here. We're ready to die. We have nothing to lose.
The formation of a new Iraqi government has been paralyzed since parliamentary elections in October, where al-Sadr's Sadrist movement won the most seats but failed to win an outright majority. Al-Sadr's supporters had occupied the Iraqi parliament since late July in an effort to block lawmakers from choosing a new prime minister. Pakistan's government has launched a major appeal for international aid after unprecedented monsoon rains fueled by the climate crisis swept away homes and bridges, destroyed crops, displaced tens of millions of people, killed over 1,000. On Monday, Pakistan's climate minister, Sherry Raymond, declared, "It is climate dystopia at our doorstep."
One-third of Pakistan is underwater, and 33 million are affected. Please tell me how that is not catastrophic. That is the size of a small country.
Pakistan's planning minister estimated the cost of rebuilding at over $10 billion and said that figure is likely to rise once rescue crews are able to access remote areas cut off by floodwaters. Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves has declared a state of emergency in the capital, Jackson, and will mobilize the National Guard after torrential rains caused the Pearl River to overtop its banks, flooding a water treatment plant. Governor Reeves said Monday evening, emergency workers are scrambling to deliver potable water to 180,000 people around Jackson who lack enough water to flush toilets or fight fires.
Please stay safe. Do not drink the water. In too many cases, it is raw water from the reservoir being pushed through the pipes.
It's the latest crisis to impact aging infrastructure in Jackson, where officials estimate the cost of fixing the city's water system could top $2 billion. In early 2021, Jackson residents spent more than a month under boil water orders after winter storms caused pipes and water mains to burst. 82% of Jackson's residents are Black. A new study finds Greenland's melting ice sheet will likely contribute almost a foot to global sea level rise by the end of the century. Writing in the journal Nature Climate Change, researchers found even if the world were to halt all greenhouse gas emissions today, rising levels of atmospheric carbon dioxide have already doomed 120 trillion tons of Greenland's ice to melt. Without urgent action to mitigate the damage, researchers warn the amount of sea level rise could be far higher. Here in New York, a fifth round of talks aimed at protecting the world's marine wildlife has ended in failure. On Saturday, negotiations on an updated United Nations Ocean Treaty ended without an agreement after wealthy countries, including the U.S. and Canada, rejected a plan to establish marine protected areas spanning 30% of the world's oceans. Ukraine has launched a counteroffensive aimed at retaking the city of Kherson and other parts of southern Ukraine occupied by Russia. On Monday, Ukraine's military said it had broken through Russia's first line of defense and that Russian proxy forces and paratroopers had fled the battlefield. Russia acknowledged the counteroffensive but claimed it had failed and that Ukraine has suffered heavy losses. Meanwhile, a team of inspectors with the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency have arrived in Kyiv ahead of their planned visit to the Russian-occupied Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, Europe's largest nuclear power station. Fighting continues to rage near the site with reports of artillery fire and a missile strike overnight. New satellite images show damage from an artillery attack on the roof of a building right next to Zaporizhzhia's six nuclear reactors. President Biden will ask Congress to approve $1.1 billion in arms sales to Taiwan. That's according to Politico, which reports the weapons deal will include 60 Harpoon anti-ship missiles and 100 air-to-air missiles for Taiwan's U.S.-made F-16 fighter jets. The planned weapons sales come after China staged large-scale military war games around Taiwan in response to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit to the island. A federal judge has recommended against efforts by victims of the September 11th attacks to seize 3.5 billion dollars from Afghanistan's central bank. After the Taliban regained power last year, the Biden administration froze $7 billion in Afghanistan's foreign reserves and then set aside half the money for 9/11 families who sued the Taliban. But some 9/11 families have opposed such efforts. Layla Murphy is with the group September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrow. She said, quote, I'm relieved the judge has taken a step toward the only legally and morally correct approach, making the entire $7 billion available to Afghans to deal with the economic crisis we helped cause, she said. The Biden administration's announced it can no longer provide U.S. residents with free COVID-19 home tests, blaming congressional Republicans for blocking the passage of more COVID relief funds that would allow tests to be stockpiled. Public health advocates have warned this could add to a surge of COVID infections during the fall and winter. Since January, the government has mailed some 600 million tests through a program that allowed households to request a total of 16 home tests. People now have until Friday to make their final order on the federal online portal. Moderna sued Pfizer, claiming the company illegally used mRNA technology patented by Moderna to develop its COVID-19 vaccine. The two companies have made record profits off the vaccine. Pfizer's projected $32 billion in COVID vaccine sales this year, while Moderna's forecasting at least $19 billion in sales. Tim Bierley of the group Global Justice Now said in response to Moderna's lawsuit, quote, it's grotesque but unsurprising to see pharma fighting among themselves over who has the right to profiteer the most from the pandemic, unquote. Many public health campaigners have argued the vaccine should be publicly owned since billions of dollars in public funding helped develop them. A federal judge in Washington, D.C. has sentenced 40-year-old Joshua Pruitt to 55 months in prison, followed by 3 years of supervised release over his role in the Capitol insurrection. Pruitt's an aspiring member of the far-right Proud Boys organization who was among the first to push past police lines and into the Capitol crypt January 6, 2021. Prosecutors say Pruitt came face-to-face with Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer during the attack on Congress. Video of the incident shows Schumer and his security team turning and running in the opposite direction after they saw Pruitt approaching. In Georgia, the judge overseeing the grand jury probe into Donald Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election has rejected a bid by Republican Governor Brian Kemp to quash a subpoena for his testimony. However, the Fulton County Superior Court judge ruled Monday that Kemp will not have to testify until after November's midterm elections, where he faces Democratic challenger Stacey Abrams. The special grand jury was requested by Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis earlier this year. Last week, Willis sought grand jury subpoenas for Trump's former chief of staff, Mark Meadows, and former Trump legal advisor, Sidney Powell. And in Oregon, a 20-year-old gunman wielding a semi-automatic assault rifle and a shotgun opened fire inside a Safeway grocery store in the city of Bend Sunday, killing two people before taking his own life. Witnesses say one of the victims, 66-year-old Safeway worker Donald Ray Surratt, likely saved the lives of many by confronting and attacking the gunman. In Texas, a federal judge has struck down a state law that banned adults under the age of 21 from carrying a gun, arguing the statute violated the Second Amendment. The ruling came just 3 months after an 18-year-old gunman killed 19 children and two teachers at Robb Elementary School in the city of Uvalde, Texas's deadly school shooting. The lawsuit was filed last November by the Firearms Policy Coalition. In related news in Austin, dozens of gun control advocates, including the families and loved ones of victims of the Uvalde mass shooting, rallied outside the Texas state capitol over the weekend, demanding the state raise the minimum age to purchase an AR-15 to 21 years old. This is Maggie Morales, whose sister, Ava Morales, was one of the teachers killed at Robb Elementary in May.
These weapons belong in the military. They belong in the war, not in the classroom. My sister did not have to die for this. It was too easy for this punk to buy these weapons and easily do what he did because of the laws that are in place. These laws should have changed a long time ago.
Today, President Biden is going to Pennsylvania, where he's calling on Congress to pass a federal ban on assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. Biden's also requesting more money for police as part of what the White House calls its Safer America plan. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
That's the clips from the – that's the latest headlines I could get a hold of. Coming up tomorrow, weather on Wednesday here on Radio Free Kansas.
The National Weather Service reported the Springfield Twister was the biggest storm to pass through central Illinois in a decade.
The West Texas wildfires have scorched so much land that it's like watching more than half of Rhode Island burn.
Biggest one I've ever seen.
I love to drive. You could say I'm an autoholic. My life began in a car, so Dad tells me. I discovered sex in the back seat too. I made my own kid there. I may die out on the road. When things get boring, I drive around looking for something else. And if it's no good here, I go there. Too hot? We'll just go north into the hills. Too cold? Off south, just like the birds. Sometimes, I don't even know why I'm going. I'm just out there on the road, rambling around. I've just got to get out there and drive, maybe for a day or two, and see some country, some trees. I need to see nature. I've worked in vehicles and slept in them, even lived in one. Can't count all the hours I've just waited somewhere with the motor running, for red light, for traffic to move, for somebody to come out, for anything. Who even hears the motor running there under your thoughts? Vibration is good, moves the blood around. We don't even smell these engines unless something's broken. I've driven them all. Motorcycles, three-wheelers, minis, SUVs, compacts, pickups, a limousine, a truck, tractors, golf carts, you name it. If it's got a motor, that's good for me. And the power, the roar, the jolt of energy, the thrill of speed. I've got this armored steel that can run away, or run over, or damn near fly. My ride talks for me, tells you who I am. Without it, I'd just be a naked little animal out there in the rain and snow, like a snail without a shell. Likely I wouldn't kill for fuel, but my taxes pay for soldiers who will, by God. Gotta have gas. And if by accident I had to run over some kid, heaven forbid, or some old fart, I may lose my license for a little while. But I'll keep driving. We all need to get around. Okay, the weather is getting really weird. You never know what might happen. If this place floods or burns, I'll toss my stuff in here and go somewhere better. I'm not walking around like a loser. Notice anybody else getting off the road? Not likely. On my dying day, when I go, it'll be sitting upright behind the wheel. Check out Radio EcoShock, the planet's only all-environment radio station at www.ecoshock.org.
Yeah, and he'll be, Alex Smith's Radio EcoShock will be on tomorrow. At the top of the hour, we'll have John Grant. He'll come on discussing the latest in the New York Times, and basically having some fun. You're welcome to call in. It is a live show, 646-716-8652. You're welcome to call in the second hour with John Grant. Now, we're going to go to the latest counterspin with Janine Jackson.
Thank you.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, corporate news media have a particularly frozen narrative on Palestine and Israel. You could recite it. Palestinians act violently. Israel responds in self-defense. There are clashes of implicitly equally empowered forces. Palestinians have squandered their opportunities for autonomy because they overreach. And finally, if you have any problem with the actions of the State of Israel, that's because you hate Jewish people. The whole narrative not only summarily erases millions of Jewish people who support the human rights of Palestinians, it also makes it hard for anyone to make sense of, for example, the recent assault by Israeli forces on the Gaza Strip that was reported by the AP as a flare-up. That passive voice left 49 Palestinians dead. The account explains that no one on the Israeli side was killed or seriously wounded, but it still tells us that it was a battle between Israel and militant Palestinians who remain defiant. Ahmed Abuznet is executive director at the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. He'll join us to talk about the reality that that formulaic rhetoric obscures. Also on the show, Andrew Perez covers money and influence as senior editor and reporter at The Lever News. He'll talk about what we should know about the unprecedentedly enormous donation, some $1.6 billion, that just went from a Chicago mogul to a deeply conservative group that is, among other things, reshaping the Supreme Court. It's the sort of news that changes your life, whether you know it's happening or not, which, yes, you would think would be where a free press would come in. All of that's coming up, and we're getting right to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights stated that Israel's designation of a number of Palestinian rights organizations as terrorist raised concerns that the designations were being used to halt, restrict, or criminalize legitimate human rights and humanitarian work. 10 European countries, and not for nothing, the CIA, agreed that Israel has not presented sufficient evidence for that terrorist labeling or the subsequent raids conducted, computers stolen, files taken, entryways taped up. The group's legal appeals were dismissed with no opportunity to defend against the secret evidence against them. The Biden administration says it's concerned and that, quote, civil society organizations must be able to continue their important work, close quote. And that's where it ends, evidently, hearts and prayers. Some might find it notable that the overt harassment of Palestinian human rights groups happens within context of the recent series of airstrikes in Gaza that killed at least 46 people, including 16 children. It's important to know that the crisis of occupation isn't a sometime thing, and that having fewer voices to hold and host debate around that will absolutely impact what happens going forward. Ahmed Abuznet is executive director at the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. He joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Ahmed Abuznet.
Hey, thanks for having me, Janine.
Well, maybe we should just start with what's been happening in Gaza recently. I don't say that there's been zero coverage, but quantity in this case is not so much the point as the quality of that coverage. And I'm not sure how much context there's been for the pieces that folks may have seen. Like I saw a Washington Post reprint of an AP piece, Gaza militants hold parade after latest battle with Israel. So, you know, given that context of U.S. media coverage, what would you have folks know about just what's been happening?
Yeah, the first most important thing I would share for folks who are, I think, still gathering knowledge about the issue of Palestine is to know that the people in Gaza have been separated and segregated from the rest of the Palestinian population because of a 15-year blockade imposed by the Israeli government. And even when we use terms like blockade, it's really important for us to help folks understand what that means. And so a blockade on the Gaza Strip means that Israel essentially controls everything that goes in via land or sea and comes out via land or sea. And of course, Gaza does not have an airport. You know, furthermore, when you talk about the situation of the people of Gaza, you have to understand that limited electricity, 75% of Palestinian people in Gaza are food insecure. You know, hospitals and health services are struggling to operate and save lives while themselves having to worry about being bombed. And so this ongoing trauma persists as long as this blockade exists, as long as the occupation exists, as long as this settler colonialism exists. And so for the Palestinian people all over, but particularly for the Palestinian people in Gaza, an intense blockade does not allow for them to experience the very basics of life. As I mentioned, the water being undrinkable at a 97% clip, electricity being something that's limited, food insecurity, right? This is average, everyday life for the people of Gaza. Now, what's also important to note is because of a lack of a actual military, you have these confrontations between these various resistance groups in Gaza and the Israeli military. And to that, I would say that the Palestinian people are an occupied population. And I think when most Americans think about Israel and Palestine, they think about a conflict between two nations, each with a military, each with resources, each with the weaponry to defend themselves. And that certainly is just not the case. And so you end up in a dynamic where these resistance groups are firing rockets that rarely affect Israeli lives. Meanwhile, Palestinians face bombardments with which we've seen, you know, over 40 Palestinians killed in this latest round of violence, but just last summer, over 260. And so this is something that, unfortunately, kids 14 and under in Gaza have now experienced five times in their livelihood.
Well, and just to the point that you've just made, that Washington Post, well, it was a reprint of actually an AP piece, talked about recent airstrikes as a flare-up that, quote, left 49 Palestinians dead, close quote. And it makes it sound as though violence is intervening in Gaza, or suddenly and intermittently there is violence in Gaza. And it sounds like what you're saying is we need to think about violence in terms of a daily violence.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say this passive voice that media operates in is also extremely problematic. Airstrikes didn't just occur. The Israelis launched the airstrikes. Also, you know, I've been hearing many folks talk about this as a defensive war, right? But I think, you know, if folks were to read through a lot of the nonsense, they'd find that, you know, this is a strike that Israel launched without any kind of defensive necessity, right? This was an offensive strategic strike that they started launching in Gaza, and then it escalated. And then, yes, the point that you were uplifting that I made earlier is that the blockade is incredibly violent. When a young Palestinian student in Gaza wants to study abroad and they're denied the ability to travel by the Israelis, that is incredibly violent and a direct result of them being Palestinian. When a cancer patient needs to access better health services in order to survive their battle with cancer and they're denied that ability, that is brutality. When a fisherman has his boats off the sea in Gaza and cannot leave past a certain radius that the Israelis grant them, that is incredibly violent. And folks, I think, are not as understanding of that when we think about terms like blockade and occupation. They don't understand how a checkpoint or a blockade being in the middle of a family who needs medical care in a hospital can oftentimes lead to death. And a trauma that, again, we have not had the chance to deal with as Palestinians because it's ongoing.
Well, and I wonder what you make of the White House response then, which is we're against this, but we're not going to do anything about it. I mean, that's how it reads to me, is like we want to be officially on the record as opposing both the raids on the human rights groups and the attacks on Gaza, but that's not going to materially amount to anything in terms of policy change with regard to Israel.
Yeah, that's right. The Biden administration is really just like any other U.S. administration in recent history. And what U.S. politicals have uplifted as their truth is that you need to walk with Israel and allow no sunlight between the U.S. and the state of Israel to succeed politically, domestically. The problem is we as Americans have no idea why strategically that makes sense for us. And so Americans, you know, I think every election we witness the U.S. president essentially pledging allegiance to the state of Israel, and we don't know what we get out of the deal. So even if we did not have the perspective of the immense human rights abuse and the colonization and the ethnic cleansing, you know, we would at least as Americans be asking these questions about why is it that our tax dollars are going to this state that continually occupies and ethnically cleanses the people. And so that's why this media battle is particularly important. That's why, you know, sources like this where folks can get a different perspective, one that's not often seen in mass media, is critically important, because there's a voice of the Palestinian people that even through it all is able to shift the conversation in the U.S. And that's why you've seen not only the targeting of these six NGOs in Palestine, but targeting of NGOs and Palestinian organizations here in the U.S. Before I get to any of that in the U.S., just to mention the six organizations. These are organizations doing critical work to support women organizing, right, agricultural workers organizing, political prisoners. And one of the orgs, DCIP, is literally, its mission is to defend children, right? And so these organizations are doing critical work to advocate for Palestinian rights, to advocate for Palestinian dignity, to advocate for Palestinian justice. And by the way, they're doing this in a completely nonviolent fashion. But the response that Israel has shown to these NGOs is exactly why we need to keep pushing. It's exactly why we need to make sure that we're involved in either BDS campaigns or Palestine organizing spaces in the U.S. that we need to donate, because if Israel is telling us that the violent resisting groups are terrorists, right? That's their terminology. That's what they label the groups who resist. But then they're also labeling the groups that are engaging in congressional advocacy and organizing and lobbying. They're labeling those groups as terrorists too. And so what that means for us is that the lines have been blurred by the state of Israel, and they're doing that because we're winning. We're shifting the conversation. Folks are seeing the atrocities that the Israelis are conducting on a day-to-day basis, and they can't, from a PR perspective, continue to handle the way the conversation is going. So then what they would do is continue to label BDS as anti-Semitic and terrorist affiliated, continue to label organizations such as these six organizations as terrorist affiliated. And that way, you know, no matter how just or righteous their argument is, people would essentially tune them out.
And I only want to add to that, thank you so much, Ahmed. I just want to add also for listeners that this idea that criticism of the state of Israel is inherently anti-Semitic, you can find progressive Jewish groups, you know, Jews for Racial and Economic Justice come to mind, but there are a number of groups who can inform you about how concern for Palestinian rights does not amount to anti-Semitism, and that should not be able to be used as a wedge to divide people in the U.S. or anywhere, that is a false conflict that's being set up by people who have their own interests.
Absolutely. Yeah, if I could just touch on that. I mean, look, we all recognize the monstrosity that was Nazism and the, I think, brutal nature of the Holocaust, and what happened to the Jewish people, obviously, at that point in time is something, you know, we are all opposed to. And we absolutely reject anti-Semitism. This is something that, you know, various Palestinian organizations have outright issued statements around. We reject anti-Semitism. However, when you colonize people's land and continue to do so, claiming to do so in the name of Jewish people worldwide, you're actually, again, blurring the line between Judaism and Zionism. So I think Zionism is to blame with a lot of the confusion that people have around Zionism and anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. You know, as Palestinian people, not only do we have Jewish folks that are in solidarity with us now, we have Jewish folks living with us in Palestine, side by side, speaking Arabic and across the Arab world. And actually, I'll note, there was a really great book released a couple of years ago by a Jewish author titled When We Were Arabs. And it tells the story of Jews in Arab lands, so Jews who viewed themselves as Arabs, who woke up every day listening to Arabic music, eating Arabic food, speaking Arabic amongst their families. And then Zionism kind of abruptly changed that across the region and of course, across the world. And so we have to reject those kinds of lines that are being drawn. Anti-Zionism is absolutely not anti-Semitism. And I can see a future where people acknowledge that. And that's, of course, going to be a future where Palestinians are finally free.
We've been speaking with Ahmed Abuzmed from the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. They're online at uscpr.org. Ahmed Abuzmed, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks, Janine.
Many U.S. citizens, while knowledgeable, skeptical, even cynical, still work from a base understanding of how politics and policy work, which is that people, numbers of human people, want and call for things, and elected officials navigate those needs while encountering and engaging the better resourced desires of corporations and other power players. Some, of course, are more or less in the pocket of particular private interests, but if they weren't interested in the public, they wouldn't be in public office. Well, even if you chuckle to hear that, it's still the basic working premise of how politics are understood to work. You vote for people to represent your interests, and you expect or hope or just throw a rock at the idea that politicians will care about people in the main and not just money. Whatever its relation to reality, that's the template that news media use to explain politics to us. Republican or Democratic voters wanted this or that. You can fight about it, but the understanding we're given is that we're in a fight on a playing field where whoever has the most popular support, even if it's based on misinformation, will win. News media worth their salt would make it their business to interrupt that understanding and tell us how power and politics actually break down. And they have an opportunity right now with the news of the largest donation, as far as we know, to a political advocacy group ever, from a secretive Chicago billionaire to a new political group led by conservative activist Leonard Leo. You don't have to know about machinations to have them matter. So here to talk about all of this is Andrew Perez. Andrew Perez covers money and influence as senior editor and reporter at The Lever News. He joins us now by phone from Maine. Welcome back to Counterspin, Andrew Perez.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Well, I guess just bring us up to speed on the reality. What do we know about this donation? From whom to whom? And $1.6 billion? What actually just happened?
Sure. So what we've reported at The Lever in partnership with ProPublica is a look at how Barry Side, a little-known businessman in Chicago, managed to donate $1.6 billion to a nonprofit run by Leonard Leo, who's the conservative operative and anti-abortion activist who played a major role in building the conservative supermajority on the Supreme Court that recently overturned Roe v. Wade and invalidated federal protections for abortion rights. And what we know is that Side put his electronics company into a nonprofit, which is called the Marble Freedom Trust, which then sold the company. You know, the end result was a donation of $1.6 billion to the group. The transaction was structured to allow Side to avoid potentially hundreds of millions in taxes, we believe, for up to $400 million in taxes. And it kept him from experiencing a big tax hit, and it preserved then the larger amount of money available for Leo's dark money operation. And we believe that this is the largest donation in U.S. history to a politically oriented 501c4 dark money group.
Can you just explain for a second what dark money means exactly and what it means in terms of democracy?
Yeah. So thanks to the Citizens United decision, nonprofits are allowed to engage in politics, specifically 501c4 social welfare organizations. And these organizations, their primary purpose cannot be on politics, but they can spend up to 49% of their expenses on politics, and they can then fund issue advocacy stuff and really work to kind of build, in this case, the conservative movement. These have become a really kind of favored route for really wealthy people to affect political debate, because these groups do not have to disclose their donors and they can accept donations of any size. So they've really been supercharged in the last decade and become kind of a favored vehicle for the ultra wealthy to influence politics.
I was a little taken aback by seeing the term kingmaker in a New York Times story about Leonard Leo. And it seems very cynical to just sort of matter-of-factly toss off the idea that there's a kingmaker who gets to decide whether or not people have the right to reproductive rights because he has a lot of money. It just seems weird to hear that just kind of tossed off as, oh, hey, yeah, that's what's happening, from a press corps, you know, that's supposed to be defending democracy. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess I get it, right? Like, if you have a $1.6 billion pile of cash at your disposal, you can do a lot with it, right? Like, you could probably parcel out tens of millions of dollars every year and just watch the actual overall pile of money grow. It does make him one of the most powerful people in politics. And truthfully, he already was one of the most powerful people in politics.
Right.
Leonard Leo has played a key role in selecting 5 of the 6 conservative justices on the Supreme Court. And he's buddies with the other guy, with the only one who he didn't help in this kind of professional capacity. He's really tight with Clarence Thomas. So in the Trump era, he served as Trump's judicial advisor, helping select Amy Coney Barrett, Brett Kavanaugh, and Neil Gorsuch, and helping install them on the court. So while he was selecting these judges, helping Trump select these judges, he was also leading this dark money network that was helping run their confirmation campaigns, supporting them with advertisements and media campaigns, and also funding a lot of other conservative groups that supported their nominations as well. So he is a very powerful figure, but I do also understand the point you're making, which is that it does sound a little crass.
Yeah, and it sounds like what journalists, it's not a thing that we could know. It's not a thing that we could understand about how things work. And it's exactly the type of thing that we would look for reporters to explain to us, to say, you know, you think you're just voting and that's a direct connection to the kind of policy and politics that you're going to get, but actually there's this behind the scenes machinations going on. And I'm not saying they don't ever cover it. I just feel that most people, even smart people, would not understand how much power these folks have behind the scenes and how indirect, therefore, your connection of, hey, I'm putting down my vote, how much obstruction that's going to meet.
Yeah, that's the real issue here with dark money, is we don't know who's influencing policy, really. We have very little information about how these groups are spending in real time. You know, it's not like they have to report. We spent this much on judicial confirmations. Like, they just don't have to report that at all. You learn a little bit about it after the fact, like a year or two after the fact, but you generally speaking don't know who's financing these organizations whatsoever. That's where both the New York Times reporting and our reporting at The Lever and ProPublica, that's where we've been able to shine a light on one of the biggest known, probably the biggest known dark money transaction like this ever. When you learn about the details about it, it should definitely raise all kinds of alarm bells. So as far as the public knows, this group has never existed. It is organized as a trust. That's not something that you can look up in state corporate filings. It never registered with state charity regulators. It never showed up in any kind of securities documents. So we're learning about this group that was formed in April 2020 that saw all of this giant windfall in March 2021, a year and a half ago. Again, the whole real-time issue, we don't know what it's really spending on right now at all. There's just very, very little transparency in this world. And they found ways to make this transaction in the group even darker than what we characteristically see.
Well, and then finally, I know that you've been doing press on this, and I'm not asking you to call anybody out at all, but I just would ask you, are there questions that you wish you would be asked by journalists? Are there questions that you wish journalists would stop asking you? You know, what would you like to see news media do in terms of pursuing this story?
Yeah. So there's a few things. Like, part of the reason they were able to really supercharge this donation and avoid the tax bill was because in 2015, as part of this routine tax extenders bill in Congress, they passed legislation that said that there is no gift tax when you give to a 501c4 group. Like, there's a gift tax if you donate to a political organization. You know, there's a question of why that was able to happen with very little controversy or fanfare or notice at all. But I think we've seen some coverage around this, but I guess I question whether there's going to really be sustained coverage about this donation or about how this is, you know, allowed to happen, and then how we're allowing this kind of influence on our political system. So Democrats have pitched periodically legislation called the Disclose Act that would compel disclosure of donors to dark money groups that engage in politics and also spend on judicial advocacy campaigns. And all of the coverage around that legislation has been treated as like a, you know, like Republicans are opposing this. And it's sort of like a he said, she said, without any kind of like context, without really contextualizing for people what this is, what the byproduct is of a system in which wealthy people can drop tens of millions of dollars, or in this case, $1.6 billion into a dark money group that can function indefinitely, can really distort the political system and policy outcomes with just a giant pile of money.
Exactly. Well, we've been speaking with Andrew Perez. He's from The Lever. They're online at levernews.com. Andrew Perez, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
So happy to be here.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you want more information, you can check out our website, fair.org. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Hi, listeners. This is Carl G. from the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m., we'll talk about prisons since the Fugitive Slave Act to the Attica Uprising to 2018 prison strike. Stay tuned for more information on strikes and rebellions wherever they occur. Only on the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. See you there. Thank you.
Basie, that's the Count Basie Orchestra, at the Woodside. You'll be hearing from other swing favorites, swing music, coming up in this set, Duke Ellington, Charlie Barnett, and Henry James. And then we'll be at the top of the hour. We'll have John Grant to visit about the New York Times, current events, and movies, because we're Americans.
I know it well, that melody. that song before. The lyrics said forevermore, forevermore, the memory.
I'm feeling so sad. I been missing. A little man, oh, where can you be? The night is cold and I'm so all alone. I'd give my soul just to call you my own. Got a moon above me, but no one to love me. Love a man. That you'll make love to me. Strange as it seems, someday we'll meet and you'll dry all my tears. Then whisper sweet little things in my ears, hugging and a kissing. Love a man, love a man, where can you be?
We've done it. We've done it again. We have John Grant on the phone. He is, that's Billie Holiday, listeners, by the way.
Yeah, I noticed. The Billie Holiday opener. That's good. Wow, classy.
I don't know.
Talking about her
culture.
Lover.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's cancel culture proof. It's proof. I don't think they'll care.
I don't know. Right, yeah.
So, what have you been up to?
Well, I was working around the yard. I was putting up a lawn sign. I just created a new lawn sign, my wife and I did. It's on a very substantial wooden thing, and it has two sections. At the top, it says, Democracy C, exclamation point, and at the bottom, it says, Tyranny No, and the bottom is... a section, it has little, almost like bars, prison bars over it. And at the top, my wife has painted all these beautiful flowers and things of democracy up the top. And we put that on the front lawn now. So the roofer on the other end of our cul-de-sac, who still has the big banner that says, Trump, make liberals cry again. Well, every time he has to bring his goddamn truck home, he's got to drive by my house and my yard, and he'll see that on my front lawn. And it will just piss him off so much, I know. So I'm gonna attach almost as part of the shtick, I'm going to attach I have this big yellow chain. It's a big, broad chain. I'm going to bolt it on there and attach it to an oak tree. Or put it around an oak tree so nobody can steal it. I'm having fun. Hey, what the hell? You know? It's actually very nice. I'll send you a picture of it. My wife did a really nice job on the flower.
So,
you know, it's not just your scrawled sign. It's artwork on the front lawn. You know?
Yeah, it's art. It's art.
Right.
There's no question about
right.
it.
Yeah. Fuck, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's great. I'm thinking of doing some of the same myself here as we warm
right.
up in November.
Right, just, you know, to amuse yourself and make yourself feel good, you know, plant that goddamn thing in the lawn. And of course, well, on the other side of the lawn, we have a Shapiro for governor and Fetterman for Senate sign.
Oh,
we still have a Black Lives Matter sign. So you know, we are politically quite well equipped in our front lawn. You know.
Yeah, just in case the summer decides to get real hot. That's a very
right.
Well, I mean, that's pretty cool. I mean, get away with that.
Yeah.
Speaking of,
this is the best you can do for suburban dialogue, you know, lawn signs.
Oh, hell yeah. Because
we really don't talk to each other here. You know?
I know. Yeah. But it's the same out here, but not real. There's so few people. There's so few out here.
Well, in a rural area, of course.
Yeah, I mean, what happens is the local gas station or the, you know, that I mean, that's the, like an outpost, you know, and it's like when you go in there, you bump into other people and you go,
right.
Like, you know, you sort of like immediately recognize them from weeks before or something. Or, you know, in one case, a guy came back. I hadn't seen him for 5 years, and he'd gotten so old I didn't recognize him.
Yeah, Jesus, that can happen.
he just lives about 2 miles away from me, but we just bump into him. So that's the only that and the churches, of course. But I sort of reckon the churches aren't doing as well as they put on. Although I do note with some bit of a prejudice that the local Methodist church has been vinyl sided. It's no longer a run down paint peeling, you know, wreck that it was.
So they covered it up with vinyl siding. Oh wow!
Yeah, it's so good it has to be vinyl.
Right.
I mean, it's picture perfect. You know.
I hate that stuff. I wanted to fix my back porch, which is all made with the railings with the 2x4s and stuff. And this guy who was doing the neighbor's house on the left and the neighbor's house on the right repairs and maintenance and stuff, he gave me an estimate of $17,000. I said, holy, you got to be kidding me. And I never even replied to the man. And I got these two Mexican guys to do it for $7,000, you know, and they did a fine job. You know, they used 2x4s and all that. So, yeah, I mean, vinyl is expensive for one thing. I prefer good pine 2x4s myself for things. Right?
Yeah, well.
I am an ace with 2x4s, trust me.
I
do a lot with 2x4s.
Well, you're going to have to paint all the time. That's the rest of your life.
I have so many goddamn cans of paint in my garage. I collect them at the Lowe's and Home Depot where they, you know, they'll sell a gallon of paint that was mistinted for like $5. So I'll buy it. And so I have all these options. And so I'm painting this, I'm painting that, you know. I just enjoy doing this. I maintain the house, keep the property values up, you know. So when I get so old, they got to put me out to pasture. At least I'll be able to sell the goddamn house for something, you know.
Well,
these are the real bread and butter issues we deal with here, you know.
I know. I firmly agree with you, and I know there's many people that do. I mean, you know, I think they're having trouble with Biden. They're railing against Biden out here on the thing about the student loans. And
what is it about the student loans that upsets people? Is it that the people before this had to pay for their student loans? Like me, I paid off my student loans. Should I be upset that... Wait a minute! Nobody paid off my student loan, you know.
I think it's more to do with the they just don't like the idea of anybody getting $10,000 or maybe $20,000. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really a paltry sum compared to what so many run up. And there's $175,000 cap on income. I mean, if you make more than
$120,000, now I assume that's the parents that make that money. And, I mean, if somebody makes $120,000, or remember, somebody makes $100,000 a year, you know, he ought to be able, he or she ought to be able to pay for their education. I guess that means the family makes that much, right? I assume.
I don't know. We'll have to get into the weeds on that. And
I mean, making $100,000 a year seems pretty goddamn good, you know. You wouldn't
and,
really
you know,
need a lot of help, you know.
Well, Biden is not a coming from the great state of credit card Delaware.
Oh,
credit
absolutely.
Credit card capital of the world.
There you
I mean,
go.
He is
well,
not,
that and South Dakota is their competitor,
Well, he's stingy. I mean, I mean, by my standards, he's very stingy, and I think he's still. I think, I guess, that causes him to have a bump, and in the polls.
Yeah.
Also, his strong stance about abortion. About abortions, I think that that is a. I mean, there's. I think it's a. It's pushing it, the people at the bottom are pushing him into the issues, which is always a good thing. Yeah,
and I think the youth is registering at really good steady rates. That you know, I think Alito's Roe you know attack was again, as I've said many times, a bridge too far. You know, they it's backlashed on him. It's snapped back, and you know, with all the legislation that you know Sleepy Joe has maneuvered through the Congress, you know, is actually a surprise because he hit bottom and everybody thought he was a useless old geek. And suddenly, you know, he starts tacking up these wins in Congress. Of course, he didn't, you know, he didn't get exactly what he wanted at first or anything like what he did, but he got something. And so I think the whole idea that I push, the thing that I push is on the left, is you have to accept imperfection, impurity, and incrementalism if you want to get anywhere. I mean, how do you think the right wing got to where they are in the mid-70s, this ascendancy? They were on money. They were on the money. They didn't argue so much, and they all, you know, pushed and rode the same way. And they believed in incrementalism. You know, we got to start in the mid-70s. You know, liberalism in the 60s is all, you know, given us this world we hate, these conservatives say. And so incrementally they fought back, and it's taken, you know, like 50 years for them to be at, you know, in the catbird seat at the very top. Well, the left better well goddamn well do the same thing and start thinking in terms of incremental positive things instead of, you know, demanding that we have purity and perfection, you know, in the next 10 minutes, you know. So, and I think Biden and company have exhibited that. They are doing this incremental stuff because this ruling on, you know, paying, you know, tuitions and things like that is a socialistic camel's nose under the tent, if you will. You know, this idea of incrementalism. That, you know, this is reasonable socialistic behavior. It's not irresponsible at all. And, of course, I hesitate to use the S word, but I did, you know. And,
no, it's not enough. But
no, it's not enough, but it, incrementally, it's a beginning, you know. If you vote in the clowns, the clown show, they're going to crush it all, and we'll, you know, we'll be two steps back again, you know.
Oh, in their own way, John, in their own way, they, I mean, I mean, Lindsey Graham was saying riots in the street if, you know, Donnie gets indicted, you know, I mean, it's riots in the streets. And I mean, but he meant, I don't think he meant the Democratic upsurge of Black Lives Matter or the Democratic upsurge that happened, and that was nationwide, not in one city, and I think now that genuinely, you know, the Parkland shooting, there's rallies all over the country about gun assault guns now, mainly among young people, then you have then you have activity about Roe v. Wade being down, you know, knocked out. I mean, it's just like, I think to me, I mark your incrementalism by the up. the mass, or to use an old word, the mass upsurge, you know, what's happening.
Yeah.
Out of the hands of, I think it's out of the hands of Joe Biden and many Democrats, and they know that, and that, and they're, if anything, probably the best surfers in the country so far politically. They're surfing.
Surfing, right. Trying to catch that big wave. Right.
I mean, Joe just seems like a Beach Boy kind of guy. You know what I mean?
That's a new one. I never heard that before. Joe Biden as aging cabana boy.
He may not be able to walk very fast to the surf, to the ocean's edge at the beach, but you know, he does. He still looks badass with his aviator sunglasses.
Yeah, well, you know, as much as we all have problems with Joe Biden, you know, he is a bit of a goofball, and he says stupid things, and he's got some judge that he's swearing in, and he's over there blowing in his wife's ear, you know, and, you know, it's like, Joe, what are you doing, you know? It's like, I mean, the man is comical in some sense, you know, but then again, he, you know, he has that aura of legislative savviness that LBJ had, that Johnson had, you know, because he's a product of the U.S. Senate, you know, the greatest deliberative body in the world. Ha ha, you know.
Right.
The United States Senate. But, so I think, you know, as I've said, and many people have said, not just me, well, this is a third Reconstruction. You had the Reconstruction after the Civil War, the real Civil War, and then you had the 60s, when you had backlashes with the union people beating protesters with flags and things. And, and so you had a struggle, you know, between the reconstructive left-leaning efforts and the right, you know, reaction backlash. And, in many ways, it's exactly the same thing now. And so, we're in the middle of it. And, you know, it's probably only going to get more intense. I don't know. What do you think? I think Lawrence O'Donnell did a real rip on Lindsey Graham, you know, the idea of this Lindsey Graham threatening, if you will, the riots and all that. Well, Lawrence O'Donnell went down, ticked it off, you know, for about a half an hour, went through how ridiculous that is, and these son of a bitches are not going to come out and riot. And if they do, they'll be in such numbers, they'll be manageable, because, you know, they put away a lot of the guys in January 6th, and, you know, if riots happen and they're violent, they're not going to be a surprise. You know, the, quote, deep state and all these agencies that usually on the left we disdain and hate, you know, I think we should actually, you know, hold that attitude in abeyance and, you know, encourage them to take on this these right-wing terrorists and stuff like that. And I think they're doing that. And so, as Lawrence O'Donnell says, you know, this threat, this Lindsey Graham sort of limp-wristed threat, you know, it's not going to materialize. And if it does, it'll be addressed. And, you know, maybe there'll be some violence. It may be necessary. But, you know, I don't think it's a threat that's worth being intimidated by, you know, and I don't think Merrick Garland's going to be intimidated by it. I think Merrick Garland is growing a good set of balls, frankly. Nice, shy, Mr. Introverted judge Merrick Garland is going to rise to the occasion and grow a pair, you know. And,
We'll see. Well, I mean, Well, the only thing I can see that could save them, and I think even when you have Liz Cheney jumping and saying 2024, I mean, do you? Right. And then I'm that's sort of a thing that whirls around in my head. I'm thinking, oh my God,
right.
But I don't think she's going to change her positions on many things like Roe v. Wade or any of this stuff. I mean,
what? No, she's still a conservative, and she's still not somebody that any reasonable left or center person is going to vote for, or centrist even. But I think she's going to go into the primary in 2024 against DeSantis, you know, and it'll be a very, very interesting race between Liz Cheney and Ron DeSantis. You know, whether we go with a classic Republican conservative a la her father, you know, who we know did some pretty terrible things, and when he went to the dark side and all that. Thank you very much, Dick. And his daughter is in that line. But she's not a Trumpie, and so you got DeSantis is running, I think, in 2024 as the Trumpian candidate in the sense of Trumpism without Trump. You know, as in Nicaragua, they used to say, Somocismo sin Somoza, you know, Somozaism without Somoza. In other words, the man's dead, but somehow, but you continue that line of tyranny. And then, of course, you have DeSantis, the Trumpian candidate, you know, riding on that wave of all that anti-rule of law and, you know, we can do anything we want if we get the biggest swinging dick in town, you know. And so they're going to go that way. That's the way they're going. Well, then you got Liz Cheney, you know, doing a classic conservative Republican, you know, run. So it's going to be a very interesting primary. And then who the Democrats are going to foist up, you know, whether they'll – I think it would be a mistake to do Biden again, but who knows? God, it's out of my hands for sure.
Well,
nobody asked me, you know.
Well, I did.
Yeah, well, okay.
Well, I was drawing attention a few days ago, and I'll give listeners just a rough way of getting there. It's a New York Times editorial opinion. Now, she's not anything part of the New York Times, which immediately struck my curiosity.
And
her name is Sarah Vowell, and the word is just like the word vowel, V-O-W-E-L, except there's two L's. So Sarah
Sarah Vowell has a number. I've seen them in the thrift shops and things, used bookstores. And I think I've read a couple of her essays in the past. But she has like maybe three or four collected books of essays. So she's a popular essayist. With a certain humor to it, I think. You know, she's sharp.
Well, I think it's definitely humor. I mean, I'm talking. I mean, it's wonderful. It's a Molly Ivan with the 21st century connotations.
That's
I like
a good
that.
Way to put it. Yeah, right.
And she I did a little. I haven't read any of her books. I just read this one funny opinion piece in the New York Times, and it really hit. I mean, there are so many contradictions within a Liz Cheney candidacy. Now, Sarah evidently writes from Bozeman, Montana, which I have, I indirect experience with my truck driving brother.
Oh, Mark is through Boise.
He used to live up there in Bozeman or Billings, Montana, which is near
Billings.
There's only there's only three towns in the state. You know?
They all start with a B. Boise,
Billings. Yeah, it's very confusing. But I know she writes from there, and she teaches some sort of community college class, I think, or something. Mm-hmm. But I was really struck by this. So she knows She sees the people. We, as I do, live among the red staters. We don't. Well, of course, right. I guess you do. With you know, you're supposed to be a liberal crime, according to your neighbor.
Well, we're a purple state. You know,
Yeah, right.
And
yeah.
Of course, that's going to really be good for us, because I'm thinking Fetterman is going to win pretty easily. Oz is apparently not doing very well. He's pathetic, and Fetterman's running really killer ads against him. You know, they have him on his hands and knees, kissing his star in front of the Grumman's Chinese Theater. You know, and he looks like a total asshole. You know. Just a jerk. And of course he goes on and on and on about how he's from Jersey, you know. And there's something aura about, like, when you're in Philadelphia or in New York and you talk about Jersey, you know, as Mark Twain said, New Jersey was the state that caught all the effluent that escaped from Philadelphia and New York. So everybody loves to knock New Jersey, you know, and so it's an easy one, because he says, well, this is a Jersey guy. He comes to Pennsylvania and he establishes his, you know, residency by living in his mother-in-law's house, you know, and he goes, oh, my God, it's devastating, you know. And here you got this big moose that, you know, in his town of Bridgeport or whatever it was in western Pennsylvania, you know, he talks about, you know, I am really, you know, blood and soil from the earth of Pennsylvania, you know, and this guy's a schmuck from New Jersey. And Hollywood, for God's sakes, you know, plus he's a Turk and he has 7 houses, you know, it's like, really, you know, I mean, amongst rednecks in Pennsylvania, you know, a Turk
with
7 houses in like Hollywood, and what the fuck are they thinking? But then, of course, they're thinking of Donald Trump, you know, just a rich guy. I just saw this documentary last night on Netflix on Carl Icahn. I don't know if you remember him. He was, you know, a very successful corporate raider, cold-blooded son of a bitch, but he was very, very good at it. And so it's interesting to see how he worked. And he was very much a Trumpian figure that, you know, my way or the highway. And he was smart, and he did a lot of things. He could tell, you know, Carl Icahn could figure out with the numbers a company that its CEO wasn't doing the best job, he felt. And he would go in and he would get on the board, and then he would just tell him, this CEO is a piece of shit. He's not doing anything right. And he'd generally win, and he'd take over the thing and make millions of dollars himself and, you know, basically wreck the company, but he'd extract from it all kinds of goods and services and things. You know, this is the greed bubble that started with Ronald Reagan. You know, Ronald Reagan came in after the disaster of Jimmy Carter, you know, the good-hearted Southern Baptist Jimmy Carter. You know, he had some bad breaks, and, he, you know, he won term. And so Reagan comes in, and Reagan is encouraging, you know, greed. You know, remember the Oliver Stone movie, Wall Street, with Howard Gecko, Greed is Good, you know. Well, they showed that Oliver Stone, whose father was a stockbroker, designed his character, Michael Douglas's Gecko character, along Carl Icahn. In fact, he has a number of the quotes that Michael Douglas gives in the movie are directly from Carl Icahn. And so these people thrived in the Reagan period and after that. Again, this is all the ascendancy of the right, and here we are, you know. Even Icahn, even this slob, brilliant slob Carl Icahn, even talks about it being a really serious problem in America, the gap between the wealth of people like him and the rest of the country. Even he recognizes it, although, you know, as power and wealth would have it, they may recognize reforms needed, but they're really not interested in giving anything of themselves up, you know. So this is where we're at, you know. All this money is going up, up, up. And how do we get it back down? How do we redistribute it? Because, you know, once you talk about redistribution, you're talking about, you know, I mean, suddenly you're a communist and all this, you know. Anyway, I was just a digression.
Yeah. I think things are even more different than Carl Icahn. I remember the laudatory articles reading about Carl Icahn.
Right.
How he saved corporate America. You know,
that's his argument.
Cutting the fat. I mean, that's all you got out here. So, I don't know. Where'd you see this at? Where'd you see it at?
Oh, it's a Netflix documentary.
Okay.
You know, Netflix, mind-boggling, the extent of Netflix. There's, you know, they get Latin American films. It's an embarrassment of riches. There's just so much stuff on Netflix. And it's easy to work around, like the rest of them, HBO Max and all this. Like, you know, you have to go to your phone, and it's a pain in
the ass. Right.
Anyway, but it's on. It's on. I forget the title of it, but.
Maybe it'll come. You'll get it here.
Yeah.
In a little while.
Interesting, but
Carl
it's interesting.
Carl
Icahn, I-C-A-H-N. An American. Character, who obviously is very smart and has figured out how to, attack the arrogance. I mean, he actually claims to improve these companies, and because he had this one he got on the board of, and the guy was just, you know, abusive and bullying and threatening him and telling, don't you say a word at this meeting. Well, you know, you don't tell Carl Icahn that kind of stuff, because the meeting went on and there was one ally he had on the board, and he just blurted out and, you know, devastated this asshole CEO that was doing something stupid and cut him down to size and then bloody took over the company, you know. In the upper reaches
kind
of capitalism, you know, this is what goes on.
Yeah, that's this ruthless fucking jaws is what it is. I mean, that it's for the people at the bottom who work for those companies that meant,
right,
you know, layoffs, cutbacks, no insurance, you know, things like that.
Absolutely.
All
of
them.
Oh, yeah.
That's a common thing, and it hasn't gotten any better. I mean, it's worse.
Right.
Now we have.
Well, that's the downside, right? That's the downside. You know, he may make this company more efficient, but at the same time, he's, thrown hundreds, you know, could be thousands of people out of work.
Oh.
And,
that's just counting the board, the executives. That's not counting the people. But I don't know. Today, it's different. And I think a lot of people have forgotten this drift that you're talking about. Matter of fact, you're talking two or three generations out with Icahn and Reagan. But nowadays,
right,
you've got Bezos. You have Bezos, and you have Elon Musk and Zuckerberg and this huge thing of social media. Social media, the internet, makes these things maybe exaggerated. There's an argument that it's exaggerated, but it may also be the data gets around so quickly, where it's different than it was back then, and I think that's what explains the possibility and reality of these upsurges, temporary, incremental upsurges towards making people like Joe Biden and Donald Trump, you know, have to waddle a little bit, you know. But Trump, I mean, who would be interesting to ask that, talk about Carl Icahn with, would be Donald Trump.
Right. Yeah.
Because I mean, he is the perfect sewer member of the ruling class, of the rich. I mean, Donald, I think that's the problem that many people misunderstood about Donnie. He had a chip on his shoulder. Mm-hmm. Didn't he come from New Jersey, technically? I mean, he's another New Jersey.
I thought he came from Brooklyn, or wasn't there something like that? His father was,
I think
you know,
where he...
And he took the his father's business, sort of his money, and moved over into the big time in Manhattan.
I don't know if
he's over there in Jersey with all the other effluent that comes out of New York. It's
right.
Mark Twain's vision.
Donnie seems like a New Jersey squid. You know, he comes
right.
Out.
Well, yeah. Well, you think of the Sopranos, you know, and all that. That's Jersey.
I never
I watched a couple. I never got into the Sopranos. Although it was like you had the Godfather, and then you had the Sopranos, which, you know, put the mobsters in the mainstream, you know. And then, of course, we ended up. Donald Trump is a gangster president, you know what I mean? So you can see how art or life follows art, as they say, and, you know.
I don't know. There's something about a mobster running around free getting psychoanalysis.
That was the show.
I'm telling you, that's what I thought. That's sort of a sick kind of plot line. You know, a killer getting
right,
psychoanalysis,
of course.
And living the life.
Well, it humanized him. That was the point. That's the arc that the Godfather was, to me, one of the first that established this idea of, you know, in this case, Italian mafia, as exhibiting, you know, the American dream, if you will, about, you know, being successful. And, of course, you know, you have to put a horse's head in some guy's bed and things like that, you know, in order to, you know, give them an offer they can't refuse, you know, to get what you want. And, of course,
right.
You know, and then with Sopranos, that was actually moved into a suburban, more of a, you know, suburban context of in Jersey. And, you know, to me, it was all the, you know, all of this cultural stuff contributed to an easing of the idea that these gangsters were all bad and, you know, and whatnot. But these shows were giving you arguments that, life's a bitch and you can't get anywhere in America without cheating. So, we got to understand these guys, and they're just part of them, the Americans, you know, the wonderful pageant of Americanism. And, you know,
right.
So little by little, you know, we got to the idea that, you know, I mean, just today in the New York Times, there's this article on the SEAL team training, right? And the point is they're dying in SEAL team training. The story is this 22-year-old kid is going through SEAL team. He flunks out the first time, and they tell him, well, you can go back and try it again. It's this hell week. You know, the third week of SEAL training is, you know, they try to destroy you, and they do destroy. There's deaths happen frequently. And this guy, he was at the demon. He was bleeding. He was coughing up blood. And it turned out that his second time, he was so determined that he fell into line with a lot of SEAL team trainees. And he took steroids and, physical enhancement drugs. And so, he's coughing up blood and all this. And finally, he insisted on completing the tour. And he completed it, and then he went to rest, and he ended up dead. He just died in bed. And, you know, he was so pushed to such extremes. And, you know, the word amongst the SEAL team guys, this aspirational thing, was, you have to cheat. In other words, they're so absolutely demanding in this age of superheroism and all that, you know, where, you know, normal human heroism and strength is just not, doesn't cut it anymore. You know, you have to be a superhero of some sort. And so they drive these young men to such a point that they have to cheat, and they do cheat, and that's part of the deal. And of course, then you end up, you know, with a, as they talk about in the piece, you end up with a force that is unhinged from any kind of ethics or morality, that psychopathy becomes the, you know, operating principle. And again, it's a situation where, you know, human beings are not allowed to just be human beings. In other words, if you want to compete in this racket, you better cheat. You better take some drugs. You better do what you got to do. And of course, you know, the military trainers didn't seem to object to that, you know. And so it's just another, you know, sort of indicator in that in this corrupt world that we've created in, now in 2022, you know, if you don't cheat, you're not going to get to the top. It's impossible. So here we are. You know, what do you do about that?
Here we are. I guess to corrupt your analysis, I would say, so here we are, unbridled, unhinged, Thanatos.
Right. Yeah, well, you got it. My favorite word, Thanatos, indeed. Yeah. Right. Sigmund Freud's idea of a death principle. It's almost that society can get into a cycle of death wish, almost, you know.
Yeah.
I see it all the time. I see it all the time.
Yeah. Well, I see it. I haven't taken the time, but if you come from New Jersey, you probably are. your brain is probably ran by Thanatos or some oil.
Right. I was born in New Jersey. There's no getting away from that. Yeah.
Well,
all those effluents that come from New York and Philadelphia end up in New Jersey.
And think about this, listeners and John.
Or New Jersey.
Bedminster, Donnie's,
right.
You know, it's
right.
In New Jersey. It's there, isn't it? It's in New Jersey.
Oh, well, yeah, there's Bedminster. Certainly very New Jersey qualities to Donald Trump. Yeah.
And another euphemism is, that's where all the bodies go. That's from Boardwalk Empire, another infamous series as well.
All those swampy grasslands over there, I guess at the edge of the Hudson River, you know, where it's very famous for bodies. And, of course, Lake Mead now in what, Nevada? Lake Mead in Nevada is, you know, lost like 100 feet. I mean, it's, you know, dried up, and there's sunken boats that have come up, and, you know, they're finding bodies all over the place in Lake Mead.
In oil drums. In drums.
Oh, some in oil drums. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. That's classic.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a great scene in one of my favorite movies these days. It's called The Counselor. I don't know if I mentioned it to you, but it's Michael Farentino, whatever his name is, a British actor, plays a lawyer who's having a bad time, although he drives a Bentley, and he wants to do a drug deal with the Mexican cartels. And, of course, Bardem, Javier Bardem, that great actor, is in the film. It's directed by Ridley Scott and written by Cormac McCarthy, for Christ's sakes. I've seen it three times, and to me, it is the movie for the moment. It's called The Counselor. It's on Netflix, and it's you know, it ends up, there's a scene where they're moving drugs in these 55-gallon drums that are put into a huge tank truck, sewage tank truck, this horrible thing that's full of shit, that they cut the hole in top and put three 55-gallon drums into it. Then they weld it shut again and sand it down and put shit all over it. You can't see where they welded it. and then they cut it apart again and take it out. And some of the drums are filled with drugs, and some of them are filled with bodies in, pozole, they call
it. Oh, man.
The joke down in Mexico, the famous soup called pozole. Well, the cartels are famous for, and this was even a dark joke in this movie, that they open the top of this lid and there's this guy and this formaldehyde, oh my God, they close it. And, the point is these, according to this joke, these barrels are just taken everywhere and, they get it, they're just part of the contraband. This is the way of the, talk about Thanatos, for Christ's sakes. The Mexican drug cartels are nothing but Thanatos. Everything, this is the country of the Day of the Fucking Dead, as my friend would say, they make a major meal out of it, this is Mexico, and, they don't know what to do about these cartels. They're so absolutely violent and unapproachable. They've just discovered, they just fired some official who was involved in the famous case in the last, 3 years ago, where 43 high school students were disappeared and ended up in 55-gallon drums somewhere. Because they had absconded with some buses and were going to demonstrate in Mexico City against one of the outrages in the 70s where they killed hundreds of students in Mexico City. Well, they waylaid these students and killed all 43 of them and disappeared them and created another Mexican thanatotic crisis that people are trying to figure out. So, this is the world we live in. The Mexican cartels are beyond there's no way to get at them because they're so powerful and they're so absolutely ruthless. And that's the point of this film, The Counselor, and Brad Pitt's in it, and he's one of the guys working with them. And the point is something goes awry in this guy's deal. He has nothing to do. It's just absolute chance. He had nothing whatsoever absolutely to do with it. And as everybody goes, well, that's just too bad. I mean, they don't care. You're dead, man. You're just fucking dead. And, wow, it's pretty scary because...
I'm going to have to watch that. I mean,
yeah, The Counselor, it is... Ridley Scott is really, really good filmmaker. The other one of his that I thought was really fascinating is called The Duel with Matt Damon as a medieval illiterate knight who has this vendetta against this other guy, and they end up having a duel. And it's just incredible. If you think about, which I just talked with my lawyer friend in L.A. who studies medieval stuff, that I think medievalism is seeping back into our lives. This the nation-state era and the Enlightenment are sort of under attack, that it opens a space that this kind of medievalism seeps in. And, I asked my friend in L.A., a lawyer, he said, well, what do you learn? How would you describe this medievalism versus medievalism? He says, it's magic and thuggery. That's how he summed up medievalism. And as if we aren't reverting to magic, with religions and God knows what else, and, our entertainment we see as magic. It's almost you can enter a magical world, and the rules of reality are now up in question. And so what's left? We got magic and, thuggery. Look at January 6th. If that's not an example of medieval thuggery, I don't know what is. And, This is the world we've made, and we're living in it, and it's complicated. All the people who want to make it simple, one of these days it's going to turn around and whack them in the back of the head,
Well, I think it's more likely everybody buying AR-15s, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I think that's the reality. Anyway.
What? Yeah, but what does an AR-15 supposedly do in your mental, in your mind, in your fantasy?
Yeah.
The whole idea of an AR-15 is to make life simple. Somebody you don't like has ideas that you don't appreciate. Well, instead of addressing them, negotiating with them, in converse, you fucking kill them. It's very simple that way, AR-15 is an instrument for simplicity.
Another example of pure Thanatos, coming out of the barrel.
Absolutely, there it is. Yeah. And of course, Chris Hedges, a wonderful commentary in his book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, great book, has a whole chapter on Eros, Freud's Eros and Thanatos, which is where I picked up on it. And it's a wonderful thing to read if people would ever get a hold of that book. War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. He explains Eros and Thanatos, given his experiences in El Salvador, in Bosnia, and all the horrible things that went on there. He gives credence to this Freudian idea. Of course, Freud is debunked at the wazoo nowadays. But at the same time, Freud was an incredibly interesting writer. Just to read some of his later stuff, as he was in communication with Einstein, two great minds trying to figure out why between the wars, World War I, World War II, why the world seemed doomed and destined to destroy itself by having an incredible conflagration, which turned out to be World War II. And these two guys couldn't figure it out. They just could not figure out why. This is, it's almost a cyclical thing that why societies get to the point that, it's almost like forest fires have to clear up things and things, It's a real spooky kind of analysis of human nature when you think about these great minds of psychology and engineering and physics trying to figure out why humanity is destined to destroy itself. And some strain of humanity wants to destroy itself. This is all abstract stuff. And
this is a – well, John – you can always, is Donald Trump so benign that he has his Bedminster, New Jersey golf resort, and he buries his wife, his first wife, on the first drive, he buries it. That's where her grave is.
Uh-huh.
And then he plays golf with Saudi Arabians, princes.
Right, I know he's played into that whole new. Well, that's part of Jared Kushner, his son-in-law's, who just has a big book out, by the way. But Jared Kushner is responsible for what the Abrahamic, whatever the hell, Abraham treaties or whatever they call it, in which they cite Abraham in the Bible to link up between Israel and Saudi Arabia, which is a major, major coup on their part because, the Israelis no longer rely so much on the United States. Obviously, we pay them millions and billions of dollars still, but we don't have that much authority over them anymore because they're, Jared Kushner's Abraham thing, whatever they worked out, It's all Israel is now working with allies within the Middle East. It doesn't need the United States anymore, and it's linked up with Saudi Arabia and the Emirates and whatnot, vis-a-vis Iran, which of course is the boogeyman. And of course, Iraq now, I just read this morning, is going through great turmoil with Sadr, the Shiite who has fought the United States and who is now saying he's getting out of politics. He said that before, but each time he gets out of politics, it starts riots amongst the Shiites. And now there's Shiites that are, you know, on the verge of taking over the government of Iraq, which, of course, you know, Iranian Shiites, which, of course, is, we can thank George W. Bush and Rumsfeld and Cheney for that. Thank you very much. You turned Iraq over to our worst enemy, and now, you know, here we are. You know, it's like you look at the history of the last 30 years and you go like, wow, wow. Clown show, you know. Sorry.
Well, it's a very violent clown show, I'll tell you that. That's what amazes me. It's always in the background. But is it benign? That's why it was my point.
I don't think it's benign at all. I don't think it's benign.
Malignant
is more of the word.
Our representatives are right. I gotta give it to New Jersey. Dr. Oz, Donald Trump. Tony Soprano.
But listen, as I said, I am a product of New Jersey. I was born in Teaneck, New Jersey, in the Catholic hospital, the same hospital as Ricky Nelson. He's also New Jersey, Ricky Nelson. Yeah.
So this is Florida, before Florida, as a cracker.
Right. This was, you know, I moved from Pearl River, New York, ultimately, when I was 10 or 11. We had a house with white pillars in the front, a colonial house, beautiful big house. And my father moved us down to, ultimately, a concrete block shack in the agricultural area of South Dade County, almost on the Keys.
But what's the Jersey connection?
I was born in New Jersey, and then when I was 5, we were moved to New York State, where my father got a job at a pharmaceutical company, and then he lost his mind and went to Florida. That's the short version. Dad ran amok and took the family to South Dade County, Florida. All right, Mike, take care.
John Grant from the Joyce's.